Let's finish up with the break. As we go toward the finish line for our conference.
Oh, this is more like a...
I'll tell you the general order of our session now will be to discuss a case study of religious freedom in Brazil. We're grateful to have with us today two distinguished panelists who will help us with that case study. And before I introduce them, let me also say that we'll go directly from this session on Brazil, we'll go directly into the final and concluding session where we have some wrap-up. Both of these sessions are more abbreviated than the previous sessions in case people are wondering about their time. Although if you look at the program itself, you'll notice that the case study on Brazil actually extends until 4 a.m. So, if you didn't bring your sleeping bag, we might have a break so that you can go get it. We will go straight from the Brazil presentation into our final concluding session, which is a briefer wrap-up session. Well, it's my privilege to recognize for the wrap-up our distinguished colleague and the director of the International Center for Law and Religion Studies, Professor Cole Durham, who is my colleague and my employer. I've got to say nice things about him, right? Actually, I could go on and on about nice things about him, the incredible work, truly miraculous work that he's done internationally in the field of religious freedom. As a center, we've been very focused on international religious freedom and with quite a bit of success, really, and some success locally. We've participated in religious freedom issues on a national U.S. level. But it's been Cole's genius and entrepreneurial spirit and his tremendous qualities both as a distinguished scholar in the field, really one of the field makers, someone who's made this field be a legitimate field of study in the world. It's been his tremendous qualities, not only as a scholar, but also his entrepreneurial skills and his ambassadorial skills that have made such a huge impact in this particular field. I think you go across the world and there is not anyone in this field who doesn't know Cole personally or has heard of him and admired him. Currently the president of the International Consortium for Law and Religion Studies, which is a large international organization. And it's an incredible privilege for me to be able to associate with him. Cole will take the wrap-up session. We'll do the other session first, yes. You're anxious to wrap up now?
No.
Okay. For the Brazil session, I'm pleased to introduce Greg Clark, who is employed by the Office of General Counsel for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. He's most recently been assigned in Brazil as the area legal counsel for the church. He is, I think, in terms of his term of service as an area legal counsel, of those currently serving, has served longer than anyone. I think it's up to 11 years. He was, before working for the church, worked as a lawyer for Occidental Petroleum and for Exxon in the Middle East and in Ecuador. He is a former Marine officer and is the father of six children, a wonderful family as well. And to his left is Ricardo Leite, who is a distinguished Brazilian citizen, member of the church, a stake president in Brazil, who's been very involved in religious in sort of grassroots religious freedom efforts that the church has been involved with in Brazil. We're grateful to have him as well. Greg will make the presentation and Brother Leite will be part of the panel discussion. Thank you.
Excuse me.
Well, it is an honor to be here, and I'm particularly thrilled to see the reduced numbers that are here for. That means there are less crazy questions that I might have to entertain at the end. I'm actually thrilled for the opportunity. I've just left Brazil. I've been transferred to the Dominican Republic, so I've just ended my assignment in Brazil, and my greatest challenge in the DR was to keep the sand out of my iPad. But let me talk to you about Brazil and the historic sort of developments that have been occurring over the last couple of years in Brazil on the religious freedom front. When I arrived in Brazil, the question is, what am I supposed to do as an area legal counsel and as a member of Bill Atkins' 10K group, which is a special group that was put together to try to identify at least 10,000 people who might be influential in moving forward religious freedom issues in the event the church would need to call on them. And Bill gave me the assignment to try to find out how we might be able to engage the business community in some way. And as I was studying that issue of how do we engage the business community in religious freedom initiatives, I have to confess, I had no idea what I was supposed to do. And Bill has long confessed he didn't either. But he did give me the business community segment of our 10K group. And as I was kind of like Nephi, not knowing what I was supposed to do, but as I prayerfully pondered and worked on that issue, I was reading an Australian Human Rights Commission report of 2008. Where it talked about that the responsibilities of businesses doing business in Australia, they needed not only to obey and comply with the laws of Australia and international norms, but there are certain things that they needed to do as far as their corporate social responsibility as a business, as a good corporate citizen. It talked about promoting certain human rights, and they listed, that commission report listed a bundle of human rights. And in the middle of that bundle was religious freedom. And when I read that, it was as if someone turned on the light switch. And there was the genesis of the idea that we need to try to recruit the business community as an ally in promoting religious freedom. And their rationale for wanting to do it would be that it's part of their corporate social responsibility. But I thought that's pretty a lame justification for the average person in business. They're more focused on the bottom line. And so it wasn't until Robert Snyder introduced me to an article written by Dr. Brian Grimm, where he provided that missing link, that the business community might be interested in engaging in religious freedom if they understood it was good for their bottom line. And so Robert Snyder and I and others collaborated, but mostly Robert Snyder, collaborated on a white paper. And in that white paper, we talked about the war on how religious freedom is being lost. And I'm going to talk to you about that war that is being lost and this need for this new ally. And in that white paper, we discussed the CSR, corporate social responsibility of companies, to promote the human right of religious freedom. And we discussed in there the Brian Grimm analysis and logic that religious freedom is good for business, and that would be the anchor. That would be why the business community would be willing to be that new ally. Once again, I give all credit to Robert Snyder for really pulling the laboring oar in the drafting and the revision of that white paper. What's interesting is Cole Durham had invited Dr. Brian Grimm, who was working with Pew.
Your thing is not on the screen.
Really?
But it will be in a second.
Do we have some tech people here that know how to project? It looks really good on my screen.
I thought we just had to press the blank, then it would be okay.
Okay. What was interesting is that Cole Durham invited Brian to attend one of his famous symposiums a couple of years back, and it was at that symposium that I felt impressed to approach Dr. Grimm to tell him that we're working on this white paper and that we're using his research, his analysis, as kind of the anchor as to why this would interest the business community. And I asked him, would you be willing to read our white paper? He said, yeah, when you get it finished, send it to me. A year later, to Robert's credit, we were able to finish this thing and get it to Brian Grimm, and he came back with a full-throated endorsement of the rationale in the white paper. He even asked, what plans do you have for launching this initiative? Brian later would tell me that upon reading this white paper, the seeds of conversion were sown with him, that he needed to do something in an effort to promote this message that was in the white paper about recruiting the business community as a new ally. So, but I'd like to digress for just a second to try to convince you that the war on religious freedom is being lost, and even more reason for the council of our senior brethren, for all of us to become engaged. We're not supposed to become engaged just because it's a good thing. It's that the war on religious freedom is being lost, and unless we engage, it's at greater risk. For example, 43%, this is from the Pew Foundation, 43% of current countries have high governmental restrictions with regard to religion. But that's not where the bad news is. The bad news is that 76% of the people of the world live in those countries. In other words, 5.3 billion people live with high governmental restrictions against religion. Now, what's the evidence that the war is being lost? I mean, those are bad numbers. It's the increase in the number of countries with high government restrictions just in the last, from 2007 to 2012, increased by almost 50%. Now, so it was mentioned that I served as an officer in the Marine Corps. I was a very junior officer in the Marine Corps. But still, had my commanding officer, if he were to ask me, how goes the war on religion? I would say we're losing it when you have over the past 5 years an increase in losses, casualties of 50%. Okay, so all the good things that are being done by those that are currently engaged in the fight for religious freedom are commendable, but they're not winning the war. And so that's why there's this emphasis on the need to recruit a new ally in this fight. Now, to the issue, how is religious freedom good for business? I'm going to talk about it on a macro level, on a societal level, and then on a micro level, and very broad brush. And there are studies, not just by Brian Grimm and others, but also by a study from Harvard and a study from the Boston University that supports some of these findings, that religious freedom in general helps to reduce war and violence, religious freedom. It helps to reduce corruption, improve community environments, enhance goodwill and public image, where religious communities are so actively engaged in humanitarian efforts. At a micro level, it improves, if a person can live in a country and work in an environment where they can honor and have their religion respected, or where they can practice a religion, that helps on recruitment and retention. I lived in the Middle East for 7 years, and I can tell you firsthand experiences, and I was a branch president, and so I know what my members were telling me, and I know what I observed with others who were not of my faith. It matters when you live in a country where there is no religious freedom. And many expats would either refuse assignments in some of those Middle Eastern countries, or they would cut short their assignments. So the ability to practice one's religion among one's family can have an impact on recruitment and retention, and it can have an impact on morale. If things are miserable at home because the family can't practice their religion or freely exercise their religion, that impacts their morale, and an unhappy wife makes for a miserable expat. It also impacts the workplace environment where there is discrimination in the workplace. And matter of fact, number four, fewer employee claims of religious discrimination. When Elder Wickman sent me to South Africa for 5 weeks to kind of hold down the fort, pending some new assignments of ALCs and ALCs in South Africa, I learned that a good portion, a high percentage of the labor claims that were clogging up the labor courts in South Africa had a religious discrimination component to them. And so where you have religious tolerance or freedom in a country, it can also impact the bottom line and not having to waste time, money, and resources on religious discrimination claims. I borrowed this slide from one of Brian Grimm's presentations where he highlights that the World Economic Forum's pillars of economic competitiveness and GNP are stronger in countries where religious freedom is respected. I'd like to now show you a video where a particular company wanted to show that they could make a difference. As a company, they could make a difference in bridging intercultural differences between two companies who have literally been at war with each other, India and Pakistan, and how that would be not only good to make a difference socially, but to make a difference economically in their ability to sell their product on both sides of the border. And so I'd like to show you this film.
The relationship between India and Pakistan.
Oh, I'm sorry.
The relationship between India and Pakistan is one that has seen a lot of lows.
It's stressful, it's tense.
It seems it's not improving and it's getting worse.
It's only been 60 years that we have been apart. Before that, we were living harmoniously together.
I think all the strife would go away if you took away the barbed wires in the middle of the two countries.
It saddens me that we have this neighbor that we can't even go visit.
They have this perception which they've been ingrained in their heads that that's the bad guy. But when they actually meet them, they realize, you know what, he's just like me.
Mainly because there's no communication. They're near us, but we have no access to them. And it's sad, because together I think we would do wonders.
Where young people can exchange ideas, thoughts, gestures, and take away that communication gap that exists.
If I have any opportunity to go to India, I'll surely go there.
The whole idea of actually touching hands, it's like communicating with each other without words, and that action speaks louder than anything else.
This is what we are supposed to do, right? We are going to take minor steps so that we are going to solve bigger issues.
It is more about, you know, how similar we are as opposed to how different we are.
Togetherness. Humanity, this is what we want. More and more exchange.
How cool is that? And the purpose of that is just to show that companies can make a difference. Okay? Companies can make a difference. I admit that I got a little misty-eyed when the first time I saw it. I thought that was so touching. Especially considering two nations that had virtually fought wars. So what was the next step? I knew I had this product, this white paper, thanks to Robert Snyder. I recruited the area public affairs folks. I shared that white paper with one of the people in the public affairs department who sat on a commission for religious freedom at the state level. And he arranged a speaking opportunity. So I presented this white paper, the concept about the need to recruit the business community and how the business community can make a difference in promoting religious freedom. And the Religious Freedom Commission of the São Paulo Bar Association fell in love with that new concept. They saw that as a new ally for their push for religious freedom. And as a result of that, a lot of speaking engagements were arranged. And some of the members that were on that Religious Freedom Commission of this, the Bar Association of Sao Paulo were of other faiths, Seventh-day Adventist. And so all of a sudden I was getting invited to participate in Seventh-day Adventist religious freedom events. And in particular, in May of 2013, they invited me to participate in a series of events with them. And I thought, instead of quoting Brian Grimm in my studies, why don't I invite Brian Grimm to come? And to my excitement, he accepted. And I thought that if this is important enough to have Brian come, it's important enough to have Cole there. And so Cole also came. And he, Carlo Lecce, actually arranged the very first of the meetings that we had there with the, in the Covey facility. It was during these May 2013 trips that Brian and I started to strategize about his exit strategy from the Pew Foundation. He had become converted, that this was a thrilling idea of trying to recruit the business community as a new ally. Matter of fact, when Brian was visiting some of his NGOs and giving talks on behalf of Pew and sharing this idea of recruiting the business community, he was getting feedback from some of them that this was the most exciting idea that they've heard in advancing religious freedom, that the most exciting idea they had heard in decades. And so that even excited Brian even more to want to take the leap from Pew and become an advocate. And so in 2014, it started. Brian ended his relationship with Pew in the end of January. Kurt McConkie, as I tell this Brazil story, this is a story of volunteers. And this will show how all of us can do something. Kurt McConkie, on a pro bono basis, formed his foundation. And in February, days later, Brian came to Brazil to launch the initiative in Brazil. And the core message that we had, I guess I should say, Brian asked that I serve as a vice president of this foundation. I asked Bill Atkin if he would object if I, in addition to my role as area legal counsel, if I could serve as a volunteer in the foundation, and Bill approved it. And so the core message that we had for our partners, future partners in Brazil, was that Brazil is the number one leader in religious freedom. What do I mean by that? Of the 25 most populous countries in the world, Brazil has the least amount of government restrictions against religion. It made it number one in the world. And second, because of this number one world ranking, our message to our partners in Brazil was Brazil needed to take a leadership role in promoting religious freedom in the world. We have heard time and time again from in quotes from the Senior Brethren, here's another one, about the importance of working with others, forming coalitions in this fight for religious freedom. Elder Oaks states here, we must also stand shoulder to shoulder with other believers to preserve and strengthen the freedom to advocate and practice our religious beliefs, whatever they are. So in the spirit of following that counsel of building coalitions, that's exactly what we tried to do in Brazil. And here are the members of the coalition that we formed in Brazil. The church, Brian's Religious Freedom Business Association, and it's a Brazilian affiliate. Ricardo Lecce formed a Brazilian association directly affiliated with Brian's foundation. The two bar associations, Sao Paulo and then the Distrito Federal, were also members of our coalition. We work closely with the Seventh-day Adventists and the Catholic Church. Anajuri is the legal organization for the evangelical community promoting religious freedom. We've established relationships and rapport with them. And we recruited prominent business people. Carlos Wizard Martins, probably one of the few LDS billionaires in the church, Brazilian, and he became a close ally of ours, as well as other prominent business people such as Francisco Valim, who I'll talk about in a second. And then, most recently, the Muslim community. Let me just show you some pictures. Here's a picture of us recruiting the area president of the church and presenting to him the message and the need. He thought that was a clever idea to recruit the business community. Here's some pictures of us in our meetings with the different bar associations. The bar associations in Brazil are quite different than the bar association in the United States. It's actually a quasi-governmental organization that has more stature than I would suggest that the U.S. bar associations have. Here's a picture of us with our friends, the Seventh-day Adventists. It's interesting, because of our relationship with the Seventh-day Adventists, when Elder Anderson of the 12th came and on short notice wanted to, when we were looking for opportunities for him to speak, because of the relationship we had built with him, we were able to slip an apostle into a speaking schedule in a major conference that the Seventh-day Adventists held in Brasilia. They invited all of their leadership from South America to come to a particular forum, and we were able to have Elder Anderson, an apostle, speak to them about the importance of religious freedom. We also hear some pictures of us meeting with the two different cardinals in Brazil, one in São Paulo and one in Rio de Janeiro, where they verbally endorsed this concept of recruiting the business community to become a new ally. Here's some pictures of us meeting with a famous LDS judge and with Carlos Martins and talking to him about this initiative. And this other picture here, you see us meeting with a very prominent Brazilian businessman who said to us, "I'm convinced, I'm converted, give me something. Give me corporate documents that I can use that will, whether it's an HR policy, mission statements, or guidelines on how we can promote religious freedom in my business." Based on that request inspired a project that I gave to Robert Snyder, and I asked his assistance of developing those corporate documents. Robert worked with Gavin Parker and Rob Ellis, the son of Elder Ellis, in developing those. They in turn reached out to attorneys, HR professionals, and we now have those corporate documents that we'll be rolling out in Brazil on a pilot basis, and which have been delivered to the United Nations Global Compact for their consideration on a global basis. Here's a picture of our meeting with Vice President Temer, the Vice President of Brazil, where we explained to him that Brazil was number one. He was shocked. He had no idea that his country was number one in anything. It clearly wasn't number one in the World Cup. And so this was a new opportunity for them to be number one in something. And so that was an exciting message. By the way, you can see these are all volunteers. These are people who dedicated the time. This is Ramona Hamor, a member of the church, ex-federal congresswoman, same party as the vice president. She set up the meeting. And the other people are also volunteers with us that donated their time to meet with the vice president. But what was the result of that? Was that just a cool meeting with no consequence? Like, this is a cool meeting, and the question is, will it have any consequence? What happened in that meeting with Vice President Temer? He committed to us in that meeting, and he followed through that he was going to publish an article that would have national distribution in Brazil talking about the importance of religious freedom and how Brazil was number one and needed to take a leadership role. But that's not all he did. He got on a plane with Ramona Hamor and traveled to a city, met with 30 other religious leaders, and talked about Brazil's ranking as number one and how Brazil needed to step up and become a world leader in promoting religious freedom. Here's a picture of Ricardo, who's sitting on the stand, who formed that foundation, the affiliated foundation with Brian. This is one of the most prominent business people, TV star in Brazil, and Carlos Wizard Martins, the billionaire, LDS billionaire. And we made the presentation for him, and we're going to try to tap into his business organization and recruiting the business community. Here's a picture of Brian Grimm presenting to Ban Ki-moon, the Secretary General of the United Nations, a document that was co-published by the foundation, talking about how the business community, illustrating four examples of how the business community can make a difference in promoting intercultural faith and understanding. And one of our volunteers in our foundation translated that document into Portuguese, and we gave it back to the United Nations Global Compact for their use on a global basis. I suspect one of the hallmarks of things that have happened that are kind of exciting was when I received a letter from Elder Perry inviting us, and I give credit to Bill Ackener, to Robert Snyder for having coordinated that. But Elder Perry asked that Brian and I make a presentation to the Quorum of the 12, the seven presidents, and the presiding bishopric, and that group is called the Area Committee. And we were asked to present to them how the business community can more effectively promote religious freedom and tell us about these initiatives in Brazil. And so we did. And during that presentation, one of the members of the 12 asked me, "Well, Greg and Brian, are you receiving any resistance from the business community on this message that they need to become engaged in and becoming allies and promoting religious freedom. And my response to that member of the 12 and to the 12 and the other brethren was, the first question out of the mouth of any LDS business person is, where are the senior brethren on this initiative? And Elder Perry, with his booming voice, said, you can tell them that the senior brethren are very enthusiastic about this initiative. So if any of you have that question, where are the senior brethren on this initiative of recruiting the business community as a new ally, you have Elder Perry's response. They are very enthusiastic about this initiative. Sometime after that opportunity, my legal coordinator came to me and said, Greg, we're going to be selling a property, one of the church's excess properties, to the Muslim community. Would you like to attend the future the closing on that to see if we can invite them to become members of this coalition of churches to promote religious freedom? And I thought, how cool. How cool would that be? And thank goodness to the inspiration of my legal coordinator to even ask that question. And so I went to that meeting, and I felt him, and I waited to ask the question at a point in the transaction where I didn't think I'd queer the deal in case they weren't interested. But I asked the question, would you like to join with us and other organizations and other churches in promoting religious freedom in Brazil? And I was thrilled when they said, of course, we would love to join that initiative. Come to our mosque and let's talk more about it. So this is a picture of us at their mosque talking more about that. And while we were at their mosque talking about what this coalition had done thus far and what we hope to do, I felt impressed to ask them, would you be willing to host in your mosque a religious freedom celebration? Because how symbolic would that be if we could have Christians, Jews, Muslims, Afro-religionists, and others all together in your mosque celebrating religious freedom, especially given what's going on in the world in the Middle East with the slaughters that are happening there with the jihadists. And they said, of course. Matter of fact, this will be our opportunity to show the world that not all Muslims are extremists, are not jihadists. And so the planning went on for that event over a number of months. And what was the result of that planning? Many of you have already read about it in the church news. It was a historic event. We had six general authorities attend that event. The entire area presidency, Bishop Cosse, President Clayton of the Seven Presidents, and Elder Christofferson. And Elder Christofferson was the keynote speaker at that event. Here in this picture, you'll see that we have representatives from the Jewish community, the Seventh-day Adventists, the Muslim businessman who helped organized the whole event with his people, Congressman Moroni Torgan, who is LDS, and others, and Elder Christofferson. Incredible historic event. But what makes this even more interesting or more historical is what happened after the event. Following the event, our Muslim friends, very thrilled about this religious freedom event they had hosted in their mosque, publicized that event to Muslims in 40 other countries. Our Muslim friends, want to continue with us and continue to participate with us in all of our religious freedom activities that we plan. And this was the first annual event, and they're looking forward to us planning this next annual event. I anticipate that they're going to continue to publicize their participation in their events to their buddies in 40 other Muslim countries. How cool is that? We've got Muslims talking about religious freedom to Muslims. I think that's strategic. I've shared that view with Elder Christofferson, with the OGC, and with the area presidency. This is strategic. We now have Brazilian Muslims who can be a key to promoting religious freedom in the Muslim world. Most recently, Ricardo participated with Brian Grimm, signed a letter of intent with the United Nations Global Compact and the Business for Peace to promote a business and interfaith peace awards event that will coincide with the Olympics, starting with the upcoming Olympics in Rio. And the purpose of this awards event will honor, publicize, and highlight business leaders who have demonstrated significant advances and innovations in interfaith understanding and peace in the workplace and community, thereby fostering increased interreligious and intercultural understanding, freedom of religion, belief, and peace. what's really cool, we now have a relationship with the United Nations Global Compact. And that will give us incredible reach, not only in Brazil, but in other countries where we want to replicate these sort of initiatives. I'll go quickly through the sort of things that we, what's our time? I know we started late, but what's our time?
We're supposed to finish it more, so you've got about 5 minutes.
Okay. We've got a lot of things that we're going to continue to do in Brazil, and we're going to continue with the first two things I've already talked about. We have projects of law that we have Congressman Moroni Torgan advancing that are supported by the Bar Association and other churches. We're going to be hosting events to educate and promote the corporate documents that Robert Schneider led the initiative. This is where the rubber meets the road. You know, how having events like this where we meet and talk about this stuff, it really is only of significance, in my opinion, if something happens. If something concrete, if this is just to get together and preach to the choir, then that's of little use, in my opinion. But if something concrete comes out of it, then that's significant. Where someone decides to act as a result of one of these type of meetings, that's significant. I think it's also significant that we're going to design a program, a distribution plan, an education program in Brazil where we can take these corporate documents and get them into the hands of the business community. That's where the rubber meets the road, not in a session like this, where you get those sort of documents in a company where people's lives are being affected because the company changed the way they're doing business to honor respect and provide for religious accommodation. Here are resources that are available to folks that are interested in promoting similar sort of initiatives, which you can't see because I'm blowing through them too quickly. But here are just some suggestions that I'll go through real quickly. If you're an area legal counsel, you can focus on recruiting your area presidency and your public affairs folks. You can build coalitions with other churches and organizations to foster religious faith. This is stuff everybody, I've heard the question asked in every session, what can I do? Or presentations on what can I do? Here are just my humble suggestions on things that can actually be done based on our modest experience in Brazil. You can recruit local bar associations or other religious freedom organizations to speak in their events. You can recruit prominent business people interested in engaging in religious freedom initiatives. And if you've got some business people that are interested in promoting religious freedom initiatives, they can talk to me. They can talk to Brian Grimm. I'll refer them to Brian Grimm to see how we can recruit you and let you join with our initiatives. You can engage with key government officials who are tasked or are interested in safeguarding religious liberty. Once again, you can involve Brian Grimm and his foundation. Brian will go anywhere. Brian loves to talk on this stuff, and his connection now with the United Nations Global Compact is not insignificant. You can create, don't wait for the events to happen, create your own events, religious freedom events, similar to what we did in the Muslim mosque, and look for opportunities to devote, develop, promote, and empower local talent, like Ricardo. Arrange for religious freedom programs and seminars for local trade organizations, including AmCham. Promote and educate and distribute the corporate documents prepared by Robert Schneider and his team. If any of you are interested in getting your hands on these corporate documents, talk to me, talk to Robert. You can go to the foundation's website. They're posted there. There are concrete documents that can be used in the business community. And then develop project law that fosters some aspect of religious freedom. I love the doctrinal reason why we're promoting religious freedom. The brethren have always said, it's the doctrine that motivates. It's not the programs, it's the doctrine. Well, here's some doctrine. As we walk the path of spiritual liberty in these last days, we must understand that the faithful use of our agency depends on our having religious freedom. We already know that Satan does not want this freedom to be ours. He attempted to destroy moral agency in heaven, and now on earth he is fiercely undermining, opposing, and spreading confusion about religious freedom, what it is, and why it is essential to our spiritual life and our very salvation. Elder Cook, my plea today is that all religions join together to defend faith and religious freedom in a manner that protects people of diverse faiths as well as those of no faith. We must not only protect our ability to profess our own religion, but also protect the right of each religion to administer its own doctrines and laws. Here's the mantra that we use, whether in the Office of General Counsel in my office or with the foundation, and I've proposed to Brian, this should be our mantra. Think big, work hard, exercise faith, and follow his promptings. And it's my personal witness that as we do this, as we think big, as we work hard, as we exercise faith, he will open doors, doors that we can't even begin to imagine. I can tell you, 3 years ago, I never would have imagined that I'd be given a presentation at the Quorum of the Twelve. I never would have imagined we'd be meeting with a vice president. I never would have imagined we'd have a letter of intent with the United Nations Global Compact. My personal experience is that our Heavenly Father is engaged in this effort to promote religious freedom. He's looking for more hands on deck. And that as we work, as we think big, work hard, exercise faith, and follow his promptings, he will open doors faster than we can walk through them. But we need to act. And I'm thankful for this opportunity to share this message. And I do it in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
Well, this has been really a remarkable experience. And let me begin by just giving some words of thanks to those who have made so much to make this possible. I have to tell you, with the exception of the experiences we had in Nigeria in February, this is the largest conference we've ever done in terms of turnout. We've had roughly 400 total registered. I'm not sure, I don't think that many have been here at any one time, but this is really a phenomenal showing of interest. So thanks to everyone who has come. But let me give some special thanks to John Best and Elise Franson and their team at BYU's Division of Continuing Education. If we continue to have meetings of this size, the law school has nothing big enough. So that's interesting. We're thankful to them for all their hard work, and particularly since these kinds of events have a way of coming together close to the end, making things a little bit frenetic, a lot frenetic toward the end. We're thankful also to Bill Atkin, his team, for the support of the Office of General Counsel and the many people who've been there from Rob Snyder, from Church Public Affairs, and so forth. We couldn't have done this nearly as effectively or with as much outreach without their help. And at our own center, thanks to Bob Smith and Gary Doxey, who have taken the lead for this conference, and also other members of our team who have made presentations, Brett Scharfs, Elizabeth Sewell, not sure, I'm undoubtedly leaving some people out, but also behind the scenes, Deborah Wright and Don Luthayer, and of course, our gratitude for our students who have done so much to help. Now, what I want to do is just share a few parting images, and some of them are scriptural, with you. It's really impossible in an event of the kind of intensity, coverage that we've had, to try and summarize. My sense is that each of you will go away with different pieces of the whole that will be important to you. But let me say a few things based on my own filters, having worked in this area for approaching 40 years. Well, 40 years if you count my law school days. First, let me say a word about some heroes. One is a hero who died, and we'll have the funeral later this week, is Boyd Packer. I had the opportunity for my first couple of years of college of having him as an institute teacher. And I remember a number of things. Well, he taught memorable lessons. But one thing was a mantra. He would say, follow the brethren. Not the brother, the brethren. And that was always very impressive because he was a general authority at the time and knew whereof he spoke. He also talked about staying in context. And what he meant by that was he told some stories from his own life about being in classes and trying to sort of engage in discourse with some of his professors. And he found that if he tried to do it on their premises, he would always get lost or twisted up. But if he could stay in context, he would be able to stand. And I think that's something that we also need to think about. There's another set of heroes, and they're found in a few verses that are given in the Book of Mormon as background of the good King Benjamin before his famous speech. And what it says, you find these at the end of Words of Mormon, "And after there having been much contention and many dissensions away unto the Lamanites, behold, it came to pass that King Benjamin, with the assistance of the holy prophets who were among his people, for behold, King Benjamin was a holy man, and he did reign over his people in righteousness, and there were many holy men in the land, and they did speak the word of God with power and with authority. Wherefore, with the help of these, King Benjamin, by laboring with all the might of his body and the faculty of his whole soul, and also the prophets, did once more establish peace in the land." So my heroes are these nameless holy men and women. One should not aspire for church callings, but I think one can aspire to be in that number. So I think that's one thing we should work on. Governor Herbert spoke this morning about Utah being a shining example. Let me just say a word about that. Now let me reflect back first on something that I thought about yesterday. I'm not sure who it was in the audience that talked about the Danish king who put, when he was ordered to put black armbands on the Jews, put a black armband on himself. And Gary Doxey, responding to that question, talked about civil disobedience. Now, if you think about it, the Danish king was not engaging in civil disobedience. He was not engaging in disobedience at all. He was just doing what Hitler said, right? But what he was engaged in was transformative obedience. And I think that that's something that we need to think about. I believe we are called upon to find methods of transformative obedience to law. Now let me return to the phrase, shining example. Often we use this as just sort of a trite phrase. But I've come to think differently about this as I've reflected over the years on the opening verses of the Gospel of John, which say, "In him was life, and the life was the light of men, and the light shineth in darkness." One of the things about the light of Christ is that it shines. It shines through people who are striving to be humble, nameless vehicles for what the Lord is trying to bring about. His light shineth. We need to be aware of and seeking attention and self-aggrandizement. The commandment is, "Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven," not us. If we succeed in some small measure on working on the issues we've been talking about, we will have opportunities sometimes to be shining examples, and I think that's part of what we're supposed to do. Now, I think what Greg said a minute ago is exactly right, that we can talk here, we can be preaching to the choir, but if we don't find some concrete ways to go forward, that it will be a loss. So one thing, we are working and will work as fast as we can to get things that have been said here available to you. There is a website for the conference, religiousfreedom.byu.edu. Not too hard to remember. Religious freedom, all one word, I presume lowercase, .byu.edu. Also, we will have things posted. If you go on the center site, www.iclrs, International Center for Law and Religion Studies, so ICLEARS, iclrs.org, go to conferences. There's a thing about this conference. It says more at the bottom. We'll have things posted there. Among other things, I've talked to Bill Atkin. I understand we will have clearance to have the Dina Ware movie available. We'll have that up and posted as soon as we humanly can. So for those of you who have given PowerPoints or other have other presentations, please help us in sending those. And I would say, in the spirit of our last panel, send them to Robert Smith, smithr@law.byu.edu. Okay, again, smithr@law.byu.edu. We'll track you down otherwise, but I've already had requests for people who would like to use them this coming Sunday, so if you can help us, that would be good. It's a little out of sequence for the gospel doctrine class, and our word it's Gethsemane, but you know, think about it. Another thing we would like to do, and I have to admit, we don't know exactly how to do this. I said a little earlier, one of the things we are desperately short on manpower. We desperately need volunteers, and we need some people who can manage volunteers because we can't do it. So some of you may be in a position to help in some ways. We may or may not be able to fit things. But talk to us. One of the things we thought we would do, though, that may be helpful, we'll try and set up some committees, maybe call them councils. One, and I'm just going to read these off, and we don't know how they'll work. So tell us if you're interested, and we'll think about how best to organize these. These may be something just as loose internet discussion groups. They may be more concrete, but it will help us to know who's interested. So here are potential topics, and if there's something else you think we should maybe have as a topic, let us know. But one is religious freedom in legislation. It's very clear from these sessions of the last two or three days that there is going to be an intense set of legislation going on following the Supreme Court's decision, and it's going to be here in Utah. It's going to be in all the countries, all the states that are now facing figuring out what to do after the same-sex marriage decision. Second, effective interfaith cooperation. If there are people who want to help us think about that. Working with state and local government. That may be a repeat of the first. Religious freedom issues in the schools, religious freedom in the workplace, effective use of traditional and social media, international religious freedom, managing volunteers, and of course, business. So if you're interested in being involved in some way on one of those topics on an ongoing basis, again, smithr@law.by. Bob isn't busy, I mean, no, it's. But we just need a place, I think, to collect those. So smithr@law.byu.edu. I hadn't talked to Bob about this in advance, but he's smiling, he always does. Okay, so we're hoping that we can have some follow-up in that way. Another bit of follow-up, by the way, if you didn't turn in your evaluations, it's always easy to pass on that, but it really helps us a lot to have your input and feedback. Okay. I think one of the things that is clear is that there's much to be done. It's hard to know exactly how to carve this up into pieces that can fit into already busy, very busy lives. One of my favorite statements, I've read and learned a lot from Clayton Christensen, but my favorite statement of his of all is, when you're already doing all you know how to do, and more is asked, miracles are the only answer. I can just tell you, part of what Greg said, if you apply faith and think about and seriously pray about what you might do, you will actually know some things that you might do. And it needs to be thought through. It needs to be wise. I'd like to underscore that. It needs to be wise. People will get guidance. Now, let me say another thing. Dina Ware commented yesterday on Isaiah 58 on being repairers of the breach. Now, there was a reason we were sitting over in the presenter's room, and he mentioned that phrase, and I said, yeah, Isaiah 58. And there was a reason I knew Isaiah 58, because it's one of my favorite scriptures. Maybe, probably many of, for the same is true for many of yours. It's the great chapter, it's the greatest chapter about fasting. I learned some of this several years ago when Ramadan was at the time of our October conference, which is also about fasting. I learned some things from our Muslim friends. It's important to remember that Jesus taught his disciples that when they were dealing with particularly challenging difficulties, there are some kinds of things that require not only prayer, but fasting. This kind goeth not out, but by prayer and fasting. I suspect that the Master also loved Isaiah 58. This chapter asks, what is an acceptable fast? It then clearly rejects self-righteous fasting, characterized in part as people who, quote, fast for strife and debate, and to smite with the fist of wickedness, unquote. But listen instead to the kind of fast that the Lord has chosen. Is not this the fast that I have chosen, to loose the bands of wickedness, to undo the heavy burdens, to let the oppressed go free, and that ye break every yoke? Is it not to deal thy bread to the hungry, and that thou bring the poor, that they are cast out, that they are not cast out of thy house? When thou seest the naked, that thou cover him, and that thou hide not thyself from thine own flesh. Then here's the blessing. Then shall thy light break forth as the morning, and the Lord's light will be able to shine through us. Other blessings are listed, but among them is this. Then shalt thou call, and the Lord shall answer. Thou shalt cry, and he shall say, Here I am. Then shall thy light rise in obscurity, and thy darkness as the noonday. And they that shall be of thee shall build the old waste places. Thou shalt raise up the foundations of many generations, and thou shalt be called the repairer of the breach, the restorer of paths to dwell in. That's the background, and it reminds us of one more thing. One more thing we need to do, and that's fasting, and going beyond ceremony to true fasting described in Isaiah 58. Commentaries on this passage talk about how it is about more than repairing the desolation at Jerusalem. It's about restoring spiritual superstructure of a larger intellectual desolation. It's about recognizing where breaches are and how they may be healed. My wife asked me this morning what metaphor I would use this afternoon. I told her this, and her response was, there are a lot of breaches. Breaches between man and God, between man and man, and between man and self. We are seeing numerous breaches that need to be repaired. But in the words of Esther, also quoted by Dino yesterday, how do we know whether we are not come to the kingdom for such a time as this. In the words of the governor, slightly modified, we need to be principled in our commitments. I had to change that because you have to say whether you're conservative or liberal. Principled in our commitments, moderate in tone, and inclusive in process. We need to be slow giving offense and also slow in taking offense. We need to implement the ideal of civility in our lives. We need to find concrete ways in our cities, our states, our countries to make positive contributions to the work of religious liberty. May God help us to do so. Now, toward the end of the Last Supper, Jesus told his disciples many of the tribulations that would come. And then he said, "These things I have spoken unto you, that in me ye might have peace. In the world ye shall have tribulation, but be of good cheer, I have overcome the world." Now, many of you who know me well will have heard me tell this story, but I remember the summer of 1997 when we were working on what looked like a very bad Russian law. It was the first summer, for me at least, when the internet was really working, and every morning I would get up and find out what had happened that day in Russia, and then would work all day sending stuff back to people working against what was going on in Russia to try and stop problems. And one of the evenings, we had a wedding, and I happened to run into Elder Oaks there. And he knew I was working on this, and he said, "How are things going?" And I said, "It's looking really grim." And he said, "Be of good cheer. The Lord has overcome the world." Then a few years later, I was in a meeting in Russia with the area presidency. Elder Neuenschwander, who was on his second stint as area president in Europe East, one of the great figures of our time. I told that story because things were looking a lot worse than they had in 97. And he said, "Yeah, he's told me that story too. It's just that I know how much the Lord has to overcome." And Russia today looks a lot worse than it did when we had that exchange. We face dangerous times, and have since the fall. But they will not be easy. They will take sacrifice of the kind Dino Ware has made, sacrifice of the kind that Jean Scherer has made, sacrifice of the kind that Brian Grimm has made. I mean, Greg didn't mention is that Brian, he left Pew, solid, secure, important job. Fortunately, he left a really good sociologist behind, so we still get the what I call the grim statistics. But, you know, his organization is living because his wife has a salary on which they can live. You know, there are people who are really putting their lives on the line in significant ways. I don't think we're necessarily all called to do that. Some of us will be. But I think we need to find the ways that we can do. I think we need to remember faith, hope, and charity from Robin Wilson. Remember that the people of faith need to be hopeful and need to act with charity. Thank you again for all coming. I think this has been a remarkable event. I think we at the center have learned a lot doing this. We hope that you've learned a lot, and more than that, we hope we'll be able to translate it into action. I also like to end in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen. So go forth and do good works.